Hello and welcome to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco. In this programme, we're delving into the murky world of crime in the private and social rented sectors. Some argue that it is the transient nature of renting that allows drugs and counterfeit goods production, brothels, child sexual exploitation and modern slavery to lurk undetected. But increasingly, local authorities and housing associations are working with police and others in a multi-agency way to detect, enforce and prosecute. While subletting is a criminal offence in the social sector, it also affects private landlords. We'll hear about imposters posing as landlords to steal rent and deposits, serial bad tenants and illegal activity amongst agents. Most importantly, we'll be discussing what landlords and tenants can do to protect themselves, report and recover from such crimes. Well, on the line from the West Midlands is Stephen Gabriel, Strategic Homes and Communities Manager at Sandwell Borough Council. Katrina Robinson joins us from Twickenham. She is Chair of the National Tenancy Fraud Forum and Head of Legal Services at Viridian Housing. And here in the studio is Paul Champlina, Founder of Landlord Action and Brand Ambassador for Insurance Specialist Hamilton Fraser. Well, let me start with you first of all, Paul. I wanted to address this issue of subletting. Many landlords will have faced this in the past and will probably try to talk to the tenant to try and resolve the issue. When does Landlord Action tend to get involved with subletting?
Well, firstly, Richard, the subletting phenomena has really kicked up a gear or two in the last 2 to 3 years. I've been dealing with problem tenants, as you know, for now over 25 years and started Landlord Action 17 years ago. And we have been getting more and more instructions for our legal team to issue court proceedings in the private rental sector for landlords and letting agents, particularly in the cities and in London. Here, there's been a massive problem with subletting. Normally, what we would do to get involved with regard to the subletting is, firstly, we would ask the landlord to give us proof that they know they're subletting. The biggest problem you have with self-managed landlords, they don't visit the property, they haven't done the proper reference checking, they might have gone on online portals, and a lot of them end up trying to rent the property out quickly because they're worried about having possibly void periods. But when you've got 1 in 5 properties that are in the private rental sector and the average 2-bedroom flat in London is £1,600, you can see that there's a massive market for subletting, especially when individuals from all over the world can't afford to rent single units, i.e. flats and single dwellings. So they're renting out rooms and people are profiteering. They're getting through the referencing process, albeit a lot of the time with false referencing. And then they're giving separate tenancy agreements to individuals. And then that's when we have to get involved and issue court proceedings to get possession.
Now, rent-to-rent operators have tried to legitimise subletting. And this is where a landlord lets maybe a 3 or 4 bed house to a rent-to-rent operator and they then let the property by the room. Is it safe for landlords to work with rent-to-rent?
Well, it's all about diligence. So, you know, your most expensive asset is your property. The reason why people and landlords will go to rent-to-rent operators is because they will cut out letting agent fees, OK? They will get a promise that there's no void periods and that the maintenance, the refurbished work is carried out. There's some really good rent-to-rent operators, such as companies like Northwoods and London Shed, that, you know, have got their PI insurance and they, you know, financially, they've got everything in place. And then there's other operators that, unfortunately, go under the radar. So every rent-to-rent operator should belong to a property redress scheme, okay, because they're handling money and managing money. They should have professional indemnity insurance. You know, if you are going to hand your keys over to an individual, and we see a lot of these rent-to-rent operators, well, you know, some of them want to be good at what they do and they need to be educating. And actually, as brand ambassador for the property redress scheme, we're now launching a campaign to have rent-to-rent operators to belong to a redress scheme. And I'm doing a whole load of guides, not just for the rent-to-rent operators, but for landlords and tenants, and asking questions, because a big problem is actually a lot of tenants that are actually have got tenancy agreements from these renters, the third party, don't actually know that they're not the landlord. And actually, if you're a landlord giving your property to a renter, you need a commercial agreement. It gets a bit messy when there's eviction. But I have, in my experience, and even exposed it on my television programme on Channel 5, Nightmare Tenant Slum Landlords, where you have had rent-to-rent operators keeping the rent and not passing it on.
Okay, yes, so lots of considerations there for landlords to bear in mind. Katrina, subletting in the social housing sector became illegal in 2013. What proportion of properties in the social sector are being sublet?
Well, it actually always was illegal because of the Fraud Act 2006, but it was also quite difficult to prove fraudulent intent or misrepresentation under that. So the Prevention of Social Housing Fraud Act is very welcome indeed. The Audit Commission, as was, of course, they no longer exist, but they estimated that there was around 50,000 properties, social landlord properties, that were being subject to subletting and other types of tenancy fraud, which is roughly about 1 in 100. And they also estimated, which I think is the case, that it costs the public purse around about £900 million a year, which means it's the biggest fraud to the public purse, even bigger than housing benefit fraud or other welfare benefits.
Wow, so it's important to point out, of course, that this isn't a victimless crime, is it? What impact does it have on a housing association's ability to provide affordable housing?
Well, it has a huge effect. Also, we work in close partnership with our local authority partners, and when we have an empty property, we'll ask the local authority for a nomination for us to fill that. And it costs around £25,000 a year to keep a family in temporary accommodation and around £150,000 to build a new property. So you can imagine then that clearly costs which are going to be passed on to council taxpayers in the borough or the local authority. But also, I think more importantly, is it has a negative impact on people's social lives. It stops families having secure accommodation and building communities. And it also has an effect on the education of children if they're being moved from one temporary property to another.
Now, Stephen, Sandwell was one of the boroughs, one of the five boroughs in the West Midlands that helped to pilot Right to Rent. And, of course, one area of crime in the private rented sector is housing people who are not living in the UK legally. Has Right to Rent helped deal with this problem in Sandwell?
Well, I'm not quite sure that Right to Rent has helped to deal with the issue, and simply because, you know, you've got those landlords who work with local authorities and, are accredited and work with the registered agencies. But then you've always had those landlords, and I call it, operate within the kind of grey economy, and they are still out there. So you have got landlords who are housing illegal immigrants and, other forms of activity within their properties. And part of the work that we do is working with our partners to try and identify those issues and those properties and take enforcement action against them.
And Sandwell has also done some pioneering work on modern-day slavery, hasn't it? Can you give me an example of what form this might take in the private rented sector?
Well, again, we've undertaken some proactive work. So actually what we do now is we've identified some resources to target areas of high private rented sector properties. And that will mean officers going into local properties. And a lot of them are kind of properties above shops as well. You know, we've got them. We don't know what's happening in those shops. And we use our powers to kind of go in there and see what's happening. And through those types of processes, we've been able to identify where there's been some illegal activity. We've also worked very closely with the police and UK border agency teams, I think they're called Visa and Immigration Team now, and we've been able to work with them collectively to identify properties. And we had a recent operation, and it wasn't in a property, it was at a recycling centre, but we undercovered 11 victims who were subject to modern day slavery.
Wow, and I know this multi-agency work is very important now, isn't it, in trying to find and arrest criminals who are operating in the private rented sector.
It's also about how we share intelligence. I mean, you know, There's quite a lot of people within local authority sector that are going into people's houses. And I think one of the things that we're working on in Sandwell is raising frontline officers' awareness for signs around levels of criminality, and then advising them of the right places to refer those concerns and share that intelligence.
Now, Paul, we hear of scams where people pose as fake landlords and steal rent and deposits. How do they do it, and how much of a problem is that?
Well, we have seen a rise of this happening, Richard. There's been all different ways of people trying to profiteer from the private rental sector because of the demand of the properties. I spoke to a national letting agent, the managing director, last week, and he says on average he has 11 applicants looking for one property. So when demand is so strong, and there could be an opportunity for a property that could be on for a lower rent, unfortunately tenants are letting their guard down and they need to be streetwise. We've heard of scenarios where fake landlords will upload pictures, they'll put them on various different websites, tenant applicants will make contact, you know, then you'll have some landlords will say, well, you need to pay a holding deposit, or that we have another scenario where they could be getting the keys to a property from a tenant or a subtenant. There's a chain of a line, they meet them, they carry out the viewings, they come across respectable as a landlord and give them a cock and bull story, dare I say it. And then unfortunately, tenants, because they're so desperate, want to secure the property quickly and want to be able to try and move in. A lot of fake landlords know that. They're parting with the month's rent, month's deposit and maybe other fees. And then, of course, when it comes to moving in, that happens. I mean, we were involved in a case with a dodgy letting agent called Oliver Knights, and I will name and shame because that's part of my job, right, who has since got out of business, surprise, surprise. And they had a scam that was going on with some subtenants, with fake tenancy agreements, and I was acting for the head landlord, and there was some Chinese students that came over the property. It was a lovely property in Canary Wharf, and we knew two separate couples that had gone in to do viewings and had paid money, and they kept on saying, we're going to send you a tenancy agreement, and they just scammed the money. So it does happen a lot, and I have spoken to Trading Standards in the past, and they say that it is rising.
And we're seeing a rise of scams in Airbnb as well, is that right?
Yes, we have. So that's really happened in the last year to 2 years. There's two ways of looking at this, Richard. One way is a landlord rents their property out to a tenant, they pass all the referencing, and then what happens is the tenant will upload the property on Airbnb and the landlord finds out about it once he gets loads of complaints, albeit via the letting agent or whether he's self-managed. The problem that you have with Airbnb, and again, we exposed this in the last series, we had a lady in Chiswick and she rented a property, she was going away to Africa to do some charity work, rented out for an agent with a 2-year tenancy agreement with no break clause. This guy was a junior doctor. He had no plans of living in the property. He had another Airbnb on the go, and he put up petitions and he made it into a boutique hotel, dare I say, off Chiswick High Street. And he was making about £5,000-6,000 a month.
Right.
And the problems you have with that as the landlord, unsuspecting landlord, is you have breaches with your HMO regulations, you have breaches with your insurance. There's a problem, obviously, with it when naturally the council will go around and make various complaints. Problems with the noise abatement teams, problems with the neighbours. If it's in a block, you could obviously have the lease foreclosed, and we had that in a beautiful block near the Royal Albert Hall, and we had to act on that quickly. And then, of course, you have problems possibly with your mortgage as well. So that relates to tenants that are unsuspectingly subletting. Then what's happening now is landlords are thinking, you know what, I can make more money at Airbnb than I can renting out in the private rental sector. So now we have a problem where landlords are taking that property out, much needed property, because of our natural housing shortage, and then sticking it on Airbnb. And there's something like 33,000 listings in London alone. The good thing is recently Airbnb have now limited to make sure that only 90 days are listed, because anything above 90 days is a breach of the law, because obviously holiday lets are listed to 90 days. And there was a recent survey that came out, and landlords that did have Airbnb had suspected that tenants were subletting without permission. And it's only when they get reports or they do visits, you know, and they see there's a higher turnover, or of course, if they go on Airbnb, they naturally will see all the postings from the guests.
Yes, I mean, interestingly, NLA landlords, NLA members who are landlords, are quite sceptical about Airbnb, judging by NLA research. Only 3% of landlords say they've used Airbnb and 10% plan to use it in the future. 47% of landlords think it's too risky. So I think, you know, a lot of landlords are aware of the potential risks.
But that's because NLA landlords are a little bit more clued up than what Stephen said, the grey landlord economy. We're talking about landlords that aren't accredited, that, you know, we get, I'll give you an example. We have 3 calls a day on our advice line at Landlord Action where landlords have failed to put the deposit in the deposit scheme. We've not even heard of it, Richard.
Yes.
And, and it only came out 9 years ago.
Yes, I can believe that.
NLA members won't have that problem because they're very well educated.
Katrina, let me come back to you. I wanted to ask about this connection between subletting in social housing and benefit fraud and council tax evasion. Can you tell us a bit more about that? What are the kinds of fraud you unearth, you know, when you look at these subletting cases?
It's usually a connection, without a doubt, between subletting a social property and another related benefit. I would say that let's take an example. I suppose you'll have one of our tenants or a social landlord tenant who is in receipt of full housing benefit. They will then sublet the whole of the property and they'll move out and sublet it to a new family, but they'll retain their housing benefit claim. So all the money that the tenant is getting from the subtenants is complete profit, of course. And we'll often find that there's single-person discount fraud as well, which has always been a big fraud, but much more so with subletting. And there's lots of other related benefits as well, because the claimant of those benefits hasn't notified of a change in circumstances, that they've moved out, they might be living with their partner, they might have moved in with their mother, they might have purchased a property. So it's rare for us to find a case that doesn't have a related benefit fraud. And the tenants who sublet to the subtenants will often not accept people that will claim housing benefit. Because if they do claim housing benefit, then the local authority will let us know. We've had a claim in for a Joe Bloggs, but that isn't the name of your tenant, which will alert us to the fraud that's taking place.
Mm-hmm. And Stephen, I'm interested in the types of illegal factories you see in your work, because it's not just things like cannabis factories, is it? It can also be forging documents and counterfeit DVDs, I understand. How do you get hold of the properties, and what are the implications for the landlord?
Well, I mean, I think some of this is it's intelligence that's shared. So, you know, vigilant residents reporting into agencies. Also about potential intelligence that those agencies pick up. But we do see a range of things. You know, you said cannabis factories, counterfeit DVDs. I mean, I'm also responsible for trading standards. And we went in to do a housing inspection visit because it was a HMO. And we undercovered a massive counterfeit DVD operation. So, you know, we are talking about organised crime here. And, you know, some of these people who are engaged in this activity will exploit properties across a range of illegal activity.
OK, well, you're listening to Inside Property with me, Richard Blanco, where I'm discussing crime in the private and social rented sectors with Paul Champlina, the founder of Landlord Action and brand ambassador for Hamilton Fraser. On the line from Twickenham, Katrina Robinson, chair of the National Tenancy Fraud Forum and head of legal services at Viridian Housing. And in the West Midlands is Stephen Gabriel, strategic homes and communities manager at Sandwell Borough Council. Now, just before we move on to offering landlords and tenants tips on how to avoid some of the crime we've been discussing, I wanted to ask you, Katrina, do you see any of the antisocial behaviour issues encountered in the private rented sector in some of the cases that you see, you know, like the drugs and prostitution aspects?
Yes, heavens, yes. I mean, I would say we perhaps see worse, but, you know, Paul might well have some stories for me on that one. Yes, I've personally dealt with cases of murders, rape, incest, drug running gangs, some very, very serious antisocial behaviour. We will either obtain an injunction or get an exclusion order to immediately expel the perpetrators of that awful behaviour from the property. And we work very closely with the police as well, so they can also close the properties down. And of course, we will always go for possession in serious cases and have the people evicted, regardless of who's causing it. If you have a family in a property and it's the adult children or teenagers that are causing the problems, it's no good for mum or dad to wash their hands and say, well, it's not me, it's my son. I've told him that he shouldn't do this, but he won't listen to me. We have to think about the people that are trying to create nice, safe communities. And so if you have families or people causing those issues, then I'm afraid they have to go.
And Paul, just briefly, you've exposed a number of serial bad tenants. Is it right that self-managing landlords, like perhaps NLA members, are most vulnerable to these types of tenants? And can you give me an example?
Oh, how long have you got? So, you know, like I said to you, we've done 35 to 40,000 instructions in 17 years. We have, it's funny, when I do all my public speaking, I see you on the circuit, Richard. When I say to the crowd, I said, anyone had a nightmare tenant, they all put their hand up. And I say, no, we've got a list of complete and utter serial bad tenants, who are the worst type of tenants to get. Because what they will do is, generally they will go online, they will call up and they will want to have interaction with the landlord, who's generally self-managed landlord. They will find out whether they are generally effectively an amateur landlord, how long they've been doing it. They would ask as many questions to the landlord as what the landlord should be asking the tenant with regard to, you know, with regard to the due diligence and what's your situation. We've come across, I reckon, at least about 20 times of evicting the same tenant more than twice in all these years. Now, I always again try and expose these serial bad tenants. I've got someone on this next series, and I'm trying to get all the information together. But the worst serial bad tenant that we ever had, Richard, was a serial bad tenant who we'd evicted twice, and he cost six landlords a total of £143,000. We've had a solicitor. We've had a trainee barrister, we've had a financial advisor, we've had an English teacher. So with regard to this other guy, he was the worst one. I used to be a private investigator many, many moons ago, and I got one of my colleagues to take witness statements, and we backtracked and we found six landlords, the two that I had and the others, and we worked it out. It was about a 6.5 year period, and this was up to 2011. So who knows what's happened to this guy since? He had a bit of a shock, dare I say, when I turned up with a film crew. My biggest frustration, and maybe Stephen can answer it a bit more detail as to what he does, but my biggest frustration is that the authorities didn't take action, albeit in this scenario, it was the police, because they said it wasn't a serious enough crime. And I gave all the witness statements to the police at that time, and they took no action. And I know I found out that he got done for benefit fraud at a later stage. So sometimes it's a bit frustrating for me, because what we try and do is we will name and shame, which we think is really important, because the worst type of tenant to get is a serial bad tenant.
Let me ask you about this, Stephen, because I often hear complaints from landlords that a lot of enforcement work that local authorities do is around bad landlords, quite rightly. But I hear concerns that local authorities are not doing enough around bad tenants. Do you think that's a fair criticism?
Well, I think it probably is a fair criticism. I mean, I think if bad tenants are involved in illegal activity, I would say that there are agencies that are responsible for dealing with that, such as colleagues in the police or other agencies. I mean, I think one of the calls needs to be that there needs to be, as there is a register of bad landlords, or a call for that, there should be a similar register for tenants.
I totally agree with you.
But I think, you know, part of that, and, you know, the issues that Paul's outlined is because sometimes, you know, you've got landlords who do not take up the relevant references, yeah, and do the relevant checks. And, you know, landlords are often duped by what are known as front couples. So people going in there looking like a respectable couple, but actually it's the activity that falls in behind them when they sign over the tenancy agreement and landlords got their money. So, Yes, I think there is an issue with tenants. I think as local authorities, you know, we can share information better, and I think we are doing that. So, you know, we work closely with our benefit teams, revenues and benefit teams. We also, as local authorities, well, across the West Midlands, work closely together. So I meet on a monthly basis with representatives from the local authorities around where I'm based in Sandwell, and we talk about how can we share information, doing some joint work, and improving the PRS in that way.
And Paul, you were nodding vigorously there about the idea of lists of rogue tenants.
Yes, it's been the bane of my life, to be honest. I mean, yes, I mean, I've been involved with consultation with DCLG and the Deregulation Act and Retaliation Eviction, and I was part of that working group when I gave evidence at Parliament. I think what Stephen says, I wish there was more local authorities like Stephen, and we know there's a few. But, you know, having a serial bad tenant, having a tenant that's been evicted previously or been evicted, and when you go to court, you get a possession order and you get a money order. The problem that happens, and a lot of people don't know this, is that the money order is not registered as a county court judgment, because a lot of landlords won't enforce the money order because they don't know where the tenant's moved to, or they think, what's the point of throwing good money after bad? If they actually try and enforce it, then it becomes a county court judgment. Then that tenant, that future tenant of another landlord, it gets picked up in the referencing. Now, I know in Australia they have a serial bad tenant database, okay? And I think it's got to be quite strict. So I'm planning, when I get some time, and I don't know what that'll be, Richard, but I'm planning to open some engagement with the Ministry of Justice and with some colleagues I work with, because that's the biggest problem. Tenants can be evicted. They can give a little bit. When you do a reference, a full reference, it's part of a jigsaw. It tells you where they've been and what their situation is, okay? Which is previous landlord, employment, you know, all the usual stuff and the credit reference and so forth. And then, of course, the landlord has to have a gut feeling. You know, you have to go and gut feeling, but you've got to make sure the mortgage is covered at the end.
And how long are possession proceedings taking these days, Paul? Because that's another complaint, isn't it? That it can take a long time to take action through court.
Well, it can. I mean, there's two different procedures, as you well know, Richard, being an experienced landlord. There's the accelerated possession procedure, where you serve a 2-month notice, which is a non-fault notice. The tenant won't leave, and generally the problem is that tenants can't be rehoused by the council. There's obviously the Homeless Bill Act that's coming in to saying that they're supposed to be rehoused earlier. I still can't see that happening because, of course, the massive shortage of the social housing sector, which I think I read recently that between 1991 and 2012, we lost 1 million social houses. You know, a council waiting list of 15 years or whatever. So what the biggest problem you have is that when you have a landlord that's having to evict a tenant under the accelerated procedure, it leaves a bad taste, and they're worried they're not going to get their housing benefits. So you lose that landlord out of the housing benefit arena. Then, of course, you have the Section 8 procedure, where if there's 2 months rent arrears, you serve a 14-day notice. If the tenant doesn't pay, then you issue proceedings, get a possession and getting an eviction date. Court proceedings, getting a court order and eviction will take about 4 months on top of your note. It will generally take 4 to 5 months, depending on the court you're at. And we're doing something like 30 to 40 hearings a month.
And I think the official figures are that from claim to actual possession can be anything up to 40 weeks at the moment. So, you know, you're in for a long wait in many cases. Let me ask you, Stephen, about other preventative measures that landlords can take. You know, I was reading on the Action Fraud website some tips for working out if your property is being turned into a cannabis factory. So things like if there's just sparse furniture around, or does it look like it's being lived in? We hear that it's not a good idea to take cash payments or 6 months up front in rent. Would you concur with some of that advice?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things I would say is, one, you know, local authorities are urging landlords to join accredited organisations, so like the NLA, or if there are local accreditation scheme. We've got one here in the Midlands called Midlands Landlord Accreditation Scheme. I think the work that some local authorities are doing, and I'll trumpet what we've done here in Sandwell, we've produced a landlord blog, and I just pulled off one of the old articles that we put on there, and it was exactly talking about what we're talking about this evening, you know, advising landlords of what to look out for in relation to crime in their properties. I mean, the only thing that it didn't have on it, and this was produced about 2 years ago, was the issue of modern-day slavery, so we are getting that updated. But I think much like the things that you've said, you know, don't be looking at being duped by taking money up front. Make sure that you do your checks. Also, I mean, really important, build contacts with the neighbours of the property. You know, you have a stake in that area. And I think sometimes private landlords are kind of blighted because neighbours think they've just, you know, it's just a cash cow that they're using the property for. But build relationships with your neighbours because they can alert you sooner than anybody about suspicious activity that's going on within your properties. And I suppose if landlords do identify criminal activity, then they should, you know, report it to the police or to the, well, if it's criminal activity, to the police, but also sharing information with the local authority housing teams.
Now, some politicians believe that licensing schemes are the real kind of panacea here because they mean that local authorities can identify all of the landlords in their area and it then helps them identify antisocial behaviour. Do you agree, Stephen, that licensing schemes are the way forward here with trying to reduce crime?
I think we need to look at using the tools that we have proportionately. Now, yes, you know, would I be someone that supports licensing schemes? When I see some of the issues that vulnerable people face within the private rented sector, you know, I think I spoke earlier about victims of modern-day slavery, and when you see some of the conditions that people are living in, then, you know, I do say, yes, I think a licensing scheme would be useful, but it needs to be proportionate. I think that's, you know, there are some authorities, like I think Newham's one down in London, that have got a licensing scheme, and lots of authorities are now picking up on that. The legislation's recently changed over the last 12 months or so, so I know that other local authorities will be looking at utilising licensing schemes. And I know that might not be the flavour of the month with some landlords, but, you know, it's a tool that we within local authorities have, and I think that we should utilise all the tools that we've got.
Now, Katrina, people who do things like let social housing illegally don't get away scot-free, do they? Because profits made through subletting can be recouped, is that right?
They can, yes. The Prevention of Social Housing Fraud Act brought in the notion of unlawful profits, so the person can't simply give the keys back to the social landlord or indeed have possession ordered at a county court and just walk off with the sometimes tens of thousands of pounds that they've made. So we are quite successful at Viridian Housing in making applications for those, indeed as are lots of local authorities and housing associations. And it's only right, you know, back in the 80s or indeed even the 90s, people wouldn't be pursued for such sums of money. So what have they got to lose, really? They'd give back the keys and keep all the money, but that doesn't happen now. We had, at Viridian, we'd had a check for £80,000 about 6 months ago from one chap that we issued a claim against. And we have a regular income coming in of about £5,000 a month from people who are paying off the unlawful profit debt to us in instalments, and it can be ordered by the civil courts or indeed the criminal courts if there's been a prosecution for breach of the law. So it's a good thing that we're getting that money back, without a doubt.
How much of this, Katrina, is accidental, you know, people having a change of circumstances and moving away for work, and how much of it is people being quite organised, you know, about profiteering from low-cost social housing?
I would definitely say it was organised. What some people get confused about is they think that it's okay to leave their home to their adult children, and they'll say, well, you know, my adult son is an authorised occupant, and of course the argument is he's authorised to live there with you, not, you know, not instead of you. And of course the adult child has often got a very good job but doesn't have any priority need for social housing, and so it needs to come back to us. But generally speaking, the cases that we deal with are people who have just moved out, moved in with their partner, or moved away and just simply haven't told us. They've left the place empty, or they have actively sublet it. You know, and we find the adverts, we find the information and the evidence that we need. So the vast majority of times, it is definitely people who are organised.
Now, Paul, do you have any final tips on how landlords and indeed tenants can avoid falling prey to criminal activity?
Well, firstly, to landlords and tenants, don't be rash in respect of trying to rent out your property or, in fact, trying to move in and part with some money if you're a tenant. So it's more importantly, firstly, tips for tenants. Make sure the person who you are looking to rent the property from is the landlord, is the owner. You could go and do a land registry search, cost you £3, £6 online, landregistry.gov.uk, to find out that that landlord is the landlord. Find out if you are looking to rent a room in a block, if it's a licensed house of multiple occupation. I know from a recent paper that I was asked to sit on, they're looking at changing the laws on HMO where they're abandoning the two floors. It's at consultation. It's going to be five tenants and the minimum room is 6.5 metres. It's all about the diligence. You know, find out if he's accredited. Does he belong to a landlord association? What type of tenancy agreement have you got? If you get a deposit, make sure it's registered in the deposit scheme within 30 days and you'll serve the information. And there's a whole load of stuff that you can do, but they're the basic ones. As a landlord, you know, again, if you're looking to rent out, and you make sure you meet the tenants. I know some landlords that will try and meet tenants at their present property to find out if they're actually living. Not all landlords have that time, you know, bearing in mind, you know, if you are, and I think this is a big tip that I give to a lot of landlords, is that the biggest problem that landlords have, where I come across, is that they might use a letting agent for let only. But, you know, it's about time. Landlords don't put a price on their time, especially if they are working full time. And 90% of the landlords out there that own a property are one and two property owners. OK, and there are a lot of them in full time jobs. So I always promote the fact that they should use a letting agent that belong to an association, have client money protection and so forth. But if you are meeting a tenant, you know, what's their ID? Make sure you have to do the right to rent checks, you know, see their passport. Where's their work placement? You know, ask for 3 months bank statements. Very, very important. I think that's the most important part of the referencing.
And of course, importantly, when you issue a contract now, you must make sure that you issue the deposit protection certificate, the gas safety certificate, and also the government's how to rent booklet and the energy performance certificate, because otherwise you will lose the right to serve the Section 21 unless you've done all of those things. OK, well, we've come to the end of the programme. I'd like to thank my guest, Paul Champlina, who is founder of Landlord Action and ambassador for Hamilton Fraser, Stephen Gabriel, Homes and Communities Strategic Manager at Sandwell Borough Council, Katrina Robinson, Chair of the National Tenancy Fraud Forum and Head of the Legal Services at Viridian Housing. Remember, you can get in touch with the programme through our website, which is at insideproperty.org.uk. All that remains is for me to thank you for listening, and please join us again next time. Inside Property is produced in collaboration with the National Landlords Association.